I'm looking for this pointing thing. Okay. We've got the keyword generic, then we've got a type thing. Now, we've got this idea, in this case, of a module. Now, the difference between a class and a module is that a class is something you can ask to make new objects that conform to it. A module is also a bundle of data and functions, but it's just there. There's one of it. You've heard of the singleton design pattern? If you've got modules, a module just is a singleton. What kind of things can we have as parameters, as slots, as gaps, if you like, in a function or a class or a module or whatever? What kind of things do we have as gaps that we can fill in? We've got the usual kind of numbers and types, any kind of type, and procedures. Ada originally didn't let you pass a procedure as a parameter. It required you to use the generic mechanism to fill in a package like a random number generator package with a procedure. And this generic thing goes some way to solving some of these reuse problems. Okay. Suppose we want to have some kind of random number generator thing, like, let's say, generating Gaussian random numbers. And it needs a uniform random number generator to work. Well, instead of passing that at runtime, you can say what kind, you can pass in the identity or the type or a procedure at compile time. And the compiler can generate a specialized version of that module at compile time that's actually integrated the parameters into the module. Now, there's a very, very important thing here. In fact, there's two important things about this. And the differences between Ada, Eiffel, C++, Java. In Ada, you can constrain the types. You can constrain the parameters of a generic thing. And so here, we can say not only, oh, I want a type, but we can say something about that type. We can say, this must be a floating point type. We can say, this must be a discrete type that I could use as array subscripts. We can say other things as well. Now, because we can say things about the type, and we can also say, well, look, this must be some type and I don't care what, but it's got to have these operations. And an important consequence of that is that an Ada compiler, given a module or a procedure that's generic, knows everything that it needs to know to check not just the syntax, but the actual types. It can check that this thing makes sense at compile time. Now we've got this list of things, and this is an important thing about how much can you check and when can you check it. Reuse via the loader. There is no reason why a loader could not type check. The loader used by Simula 67 type checked everything. The loader that came standard with the Burroughs 5500 back in about 1962 or 1963 checked everything. The one that came with the Burroughs 6700 checked everything. So your program was completely type-checked. When you reuse via the text editor, things aren't quite so good. Now here's an actual case from my own personal experience this week. Okay. The question has arisen whether the square kilometre array can afford to use double precision floating point arithmetic in its calculations, or whether it's got to use single precision arithmetic. And there are two considerations here, efficiency and accuracy. Now, efficiency is an issue because there's a vast amount of calculation to be done. They are planning to do most of the calculations on GPUs, graphics processing units. And while the major modern graphics processing units do support floating point arithmetic, they are very bad at it. You might think, hey, it's twice as wide, how hard can it be? Maybe multiplication 2 by 2, maybe it could be 4 times as slow. Well, actually, on some of the good ones, it's 8 times as slow. Okay, this is bad news, because that would mean if they wanted to use double precision, they'd have to have 8 times as many GPUs as if they use single precision. So on economics, the thing is, they're saying, oh dear, if we can't use single precision, we can't build this gigantic machine under budget. And this is a machine that's going to have its own 20 megawatt power station. In fact, there's going to be two of these systems. Each one is going to have its own 20 megawatt power station to power mostly the computers. So budget here is very, very important. There's a big budget, but most of it's going on hardware. So I said, okay, what kind of efficiency difference is there on a typical Pentium class machine? And what accuracy difference is there? So I downloaded the serial versions of the NAS benchmarks. This is the standard benchmark suite for parallel machines. And there's a sequential baseline. So I took that, and blow me down. One of the things they're going to be doing lots of in the square kilometre array is fast Fourier transforms, where you transform between the frequency domain and the spatial domain. And one of the NAS benchmarks is a three-dimensional fast Fourier transform, just the right kind of thing. The problem is it's written in a programming language without generics. Not only that, it's written in a programming language without type def. And the consequence of that is there's a whole lot of variables declared double, but I don't know which of them are the ones for the calculations and which of them are just convenient for some other reason. So I took the double precision version and I made a copy of all the files and I edited them to use real instead of double and complex instead of double complex and real star 4 instead of real star 8 in one notable occasion. And it didn't work. And I had to hunt down another couple of files that were in another directory and copy those and edit them, and then I got it to compile, but it was going crazy, and I don't know why. I still don't know why. Okay. See, reuse via the text editor, this code had not been designed to be switched between precisions. That wasn't the question they were interested in answering. So there was no easy way to change the precision of these calculations. The best estimate I can get is that the performance is a factor of 1.2 times slower with double precision on these machines.
And it's not because the actual arithmetic calculations are slower, it's because of the extra traffic to memory. Because doing things with double precision means taking twice as much memory. That's what's doing it. That's not the reason that applies to GPUs. So the problem here is that reuse via the text editor, this required manual intervention. I had to understand, and while the computer was able to check that the resulting program sort of type checked, this was separate from the type checking. I couldn't just type check once and then say, okay, now I know that it's going to work when I plug in other types that are consistent with the interface. Reuse via a macro processor. The next step with this, well, I actually grabbed a fast Fourier transform implementation out of a textbook and typed it in. And this one was small enough that I understood what was going on, and I was able to see that the variables that had this particular type had two reasons for that being that type. So I gave these two different type names. And I was able to do this, but again, we've got two separate versions of the program. If the version of the program in single precision compiles, that doesn't mean that the version that's supposed to be in double precision will compile either. Because what's going on here, reuse via the text editor from that macro processor, we're working at the wrong language level. We're working at a level that has no understanding of what it's dealing with. So you can only check the final result. There's nothing you can use to check the input. This thing that I showed you the other time with this code here, there is nothing here. There is nothing that can type check this. This is not in any language that has a type system. This is just basically a program that when you run it, generates code. So you have to check that code every time. So, reuse via inheritance plus generics. Now in Ada, there are special mechanisms for specifying what's in the interface. In Eiffel, when you say this class depends on these types, you can constrain those types. So you can actually say, okay, here is a class that has some type T, and I don't know exactly what T is, but it's got to be some sort of number. Okay. So again, that's enough information for the Eiffel compiler to type check that class without having to wait until it knows what the instance of the class will be. And now we come to C++, because C++ doesn't have that. C++ templates, with the when you say template, pointy brackets, class name T, there is no way in C++, at least as far as C++11, I don't know what they've got in C++14 yet. I haven't had time to catch up on that. I'm waiting for the compilers to catch up. In C++, the compiler knows this thing is the name of a type. That's all it knows. So when you give C++ a template for a class or a function, it can check that the syntax is okay, but it cannot check anything about the semantics. It's only when you get to actually make an instance of the template, when you say, well, I want to apply this, I want you to have this class with that type filled in as int and that one type, that type filled in as string or whatnot. It's only then that the compiler can tell whether it makes sense. So in fact, uniquely amongst programming languages with generic parameters, C++ has to compile a template twice. Once when you introduce the template, and once again when you process it, when you apply it. What about Java? Java got one thing right and one thing wrong, and there's a reason for it. Okay. What did Java get right? Like Eiffel, it lets you constrain the parameter types. Okay. You can say, this thing is not just a class, it's a class that is a special case of that one. Okay. So when you do that, I wonder if we've got any examples. Yes, of course we have. Let's look at Java 1.7. Why did I say 1.7? I didn't really need that. It's going to be smaller. So if we go to more classes, okay, if we go to, where did ArrayList go? ArrayList. This is the simple case where we've got a type parameter. Okay, ArrayList of E. Well, what can E be? There are no constraints. E can be anything. There is no... That is, it can be... This is where the mistake comes in, or the problem. It can be anything that is a reference type, but it cannot be a primitive type. And as I said, Ada and C++ and Eiffel do not have that primitive type prohibition. So there's nothing within an ArrayList that you can, you know that ArrayList has to be some sort of, that E has to be some special case of object, but that's all you know. So you can do things that all objects can do, but nothing else. And that's right, because this is supposed to be completely general purpose. But if we go back to what a lot of classes there are, to be sure. This is again, what did I say on Tuesday about reuse? There's a huge amount of stuff in here that we can reuse. Yeah, and in concurrent programming, it's really great. There's a lot of concurrent programming utilities in here. The problem is you've got to find them. So where are we? And I was quite struck by in 3.2.6 in summer school, the number of people who knew enough Java to define a point class, but who didn't know enough Java to realize that it already had at least three of them. So here's HashMap. Now HashMap is the interesting one. And the documentation isn't actually right here, because, oh yes it is, sorry, because I should be looking then at okay, let's go back to comparable. And let's go back to, we've got the interesting thing in Java that there is no module construct. So sometimes you have a class that isn't meant to have any instances, like math and like arrays. And all it is, it's a bundle of static methods. And so what I'm looking for here is binary search. Now there's got to be a binary search for objects. Damn it. Here we go. This thing, they're doing it in a bizarre way. Okay. This bit here, they're saying that this thing has, this thing says, we're given an array of anythings. We're given a key of the same kind as that. And we're also given an object to do the comparisons. And this must be a comparator, which has a type parameter of its own. And that parameter must be a superclass of T, or T itself. So what we've got here is a constraint on a type parameter. So what it's saying here is, this comparator must be something that we know can safely be applied to a pair of T's. Now, Java can say that in a typically clumsy Java-ish way. C++ can't. Now, Alexander Stepanov has written a book. Let's see if we can find it. This one, Elements of Programming. I've got a copy if anybody really wants to see it. And basically, he is the father of the C++ standard template library. Okay, the standard containers and data structures library for C++ is pretty much his brainchild, including some of the more regrettable elements of it, for which he had reasons. Anyway, in this book, he wants to define various algebraic structures and how you might deal with them in a computer. And he's using the generic mechanism of C++ with an extra feature, which he calls concepts. And there was an attempt to get concepts into C++ 11, which failed because the proposal wasn't sufficiently ready in time. But it probably will come. And concepts are basically a way to constrain generic type parameters. To say, give us something we can check here and now. Okay. Now this is, why am I going on about this? Because if you're using Unix or Windows or the IBM mainframe operating system, reuse via the loader isn't going to type check. If you're using pretty much anything, reuse via the text editor in the macro processor isn't going to type check. Reuse via inheritance is going to give you as much type checking as you would normally get. Reuse via generics, if it's done right, like an Ada, Eiffel, Haskell, arguably Java, this can be type checked. You are given components, and if you run that component through the compiler, it says, yes, this component makes sense under these conditions. And that says, I know that if I fill this in with parameters and the compiler says, yes, those parameters are acceptable, then the body of it is going to make type sense as well. Okay? This is something I'm comfortable reusing. Okay? So this is one of the things. We can do a mental picture of how generics work by taking the macro processing model. Think of the compiler as making a copy of this thing and making textual substitutions, which is not perfectly correct, but it's close enough to get started with. It's not a particularly hard thing to understand. But the key point here is the compiler knows what's going on, and all of the changes and the inlinings and the optimizations get done by the compiler, not by us. And it was designed in the 1970s. It wasn't that original particularly back then. But now it's finally something that we can take as commonplace. C# has this. Most functional languages have some sort of module system with type parameters. Standard ML, also developed back in the late 70s, has this kind of module system. Now, aspects we don't have time to go into, and I never did mean to, you know, there is no slide, I wasn't meaning to do it. It's something you might want to look into. Aspect-oriented programming was going to be the next big thing after object-oriented programming, and it's still hanging in there, but it wasn't the next big thing. Aspect-oriented programming was the idea that there would be things like logging, security checking, and so on, that applied to lots of places, and you would separate out, here's the core of my class, and over here you'd have something that's basically a sort of compile-time edit script saying, if something has got a method that looks like this, then do this before the method's called and after it's called. And yeah, the problem is there's only about three or four things that anybody really finds aspect-oriented programming useful for. You can look up aspect/j if you wish. Now, reuse via generator. And I've just got a minute or two to say what this is. The idea is you don't write the program. You write a program that writes the program. Or at least you write the program that writes part of it. And this goes back to the 60s, when people were doing massive amounts of sorting because there wasn't enough memory to do things on in memory, or for that matter, enough disk to do things on disk. People would do lots of stuff by sorting stuff from tape to tape. And because the machines were slow, it was critical to have efficient sorting procedures. And now, how many people here have used the Unix sort command? Okay, not enough. That's good. Okay, the thing about the Unix sort command is you give it a description of what aspects of the records to sort on, increasing or decreasing, numbers, dates, whatever, which field, at runtime, and it interprets these things. Back in the 60s, people used things called sort program generators. You gave the sort program generator a specification of the records that you wanted to sort and how you wanted to sort them, and it generated special purpose code to do those comparisons as fast as the machine could do them. Okay? So the idea here is, the idea of metaprogramming is you write something that takes a high-level design notation for an important part of your problem. And it takes that and it checks it, make sure it makes sense at that level. And then it generates code and you translate it to something else, such as Java or C. And so you've got something that's really quite small. You've got schemas for how to go about generating code. And what you're doing here is the thing that you're reusing is the process of translating from a higher level notation to a lower level notation. Okay. Now, I like code generation. It's a technique I use a lot. It's been a craft technique in Lisp for many decades. And it's one of the ways people get high performance code in C++, by basically describing the structure of a problem as a type and having the compiler evaluate template metaprograms at compile time and generate code that's got all of that stuff done already. And this is actually a very familiar thing to you because it's how people do a lot of the graphic user interface things. This is what Interface Builder does. Okay, this is what Visual Basic and things do. So we've got other levels of reuse. We've got libraries of classes. We've got components that we can use over the network. So reuse has succeeded. Okay. Most of the major languages you're likely to use have large libraries and large amounts of stuff, and looking for stuff is now one of our main problems. We need to use... Typically, this is why we've got things like package managers, okay, that say, well, I know where to find stuff, and I can download it, and I understand about dependencies, I can load stuff for you. So we've got people knocking at the door. I leave you to read these things, but I do want to remind you of two issues. One of them is that you don't actually know that something is reusable until it has been reused, because you don't know for sure that you've smoked out all the dependencies. And another one is that binary is not reusable. You can't rely on it continuing to work. So it's one of the things to think about is, oh, pest, command Q doesn't work under Windows. Why couldn't they have made that work? It's one of those things where it can save you a lot.